A writer should have the precision of a poet and the imagination of a scientist. Vladimir Nabokov. I'm looking to the northwest. That's Long's Peak. I drove up to this part of Colorado, not very far from my home, in preparation for a podcast concerning Vladimir Nabokov. You see, both his literary and non-literary pursuits came together very near here. More on that soon. In fact, there was a lodge that he and his family, wife Vera, son Dmitri, resided in during long vacations in the area. Neither I nor the Estes Park Museum history team could locate it, but I've heard it may be in disuse, or maybe gone entirely. But I did want to see the roads they traveled on so many times. It was approaching the mid-century after Nabokov became an American citizen and delivered his most celebrated novels, written in English, and one in particular he translated into Russian about a decade later. He began writing Lolita on these trips. It's a road novel that even concludes in Telluride, Colorado. But at the moment, I'm beginning to regret this March foray to high elevations, as the snow is growing thick. And Long's Peak is disappearing before my eyes. So I'm going to head back down to the valley, and we'll finish the story in my studio. I'm Vincent Hostack, and this is the Asymptote Podcast. Nabokov and the Butterflies, an episode in three parts. Part one, the journey to the American West.
My name is Corinne Shiner. I'm the Maytag Professor of Comparative Literature at Colorado College.
So we can characterize Nabokov as an expatriate from Russia, but he made many places his home. Temporary residences, Berlin, France. But ultimately, he becomes a citizen of the United States, 1945, I believe. And once here, you could speculate that he had the choice of sort of remaining in the New York, Northeastern literati community, the publishing community. But often he chooses to roam this very large country. It's reported that he and Vera and his son travel some 150,000 miles by car and rail over about five of his 20 years here. From your studies on the man and the work, can you speculate on what it was in his character that drew him west for these marathon trips?
Well, he says he's out here hunting butterflies. He makes this claim in a number of places. There's a beautiful passage at the end of chapter 6 in Speak Memory, where he links the Rocky Mountain West to his childhood home, Vera, outside of Petersburg, where he would spend his summers and weekends at his family's estate. And I think there is much in common with both of those places and where he spent the later years of his life in the Alps, right, chasing butterflies. And in fact, the very end of chapter 6 in Speak Memory, he starts off, it's a July day around 1910, and he's describing a butterfly hunt. And as he's describing it, he says, at last I saw I had come to the end of the marsh. The rising ground beyond was a paradise of lupines, columbines, and penstemons. Mariposa lilies bloomed under ponderosa pines In the distance, fleeting cloud shadows dappled the dull green of slopes under timberline and the gray and white of Long's Peak. So he suddenly emerged in Colorado. And he then states, "I confess I do not believe in time. I like to fold my magic carpet after use in such a way as to superimpose one part of the pattern upon another, let visitors trip." So I think for him, these places are all of a piece. They're all at similar elevations. They have similar flora and fauna. The species may be different, but the landscapes have much in common. And this is what he does. It's what he did as a child. It's what he did as an adult with his family. And it's what he did later in life in three distinct places in the world, but they are shared spaces.
It's at this point I should tell our listeners that in addition to Nabokov's talents as a writer and translator of both fiction and nonfiction, he was a scientist. He studied butterflies and had a deep understanding of the behavior of the creatures and the taxonomy of their classifications. The Nabokovs may have made their first trip to Long's Peak and Estes Park in the Colorado Rocky Mountains in 1947. 2 years earlier, Nabokov devised a theory concerning the evolution of the common blue butterfly. Here is Shiran Herskovich from the Butterfly Pavilion in Westminster, Colorado, just outside of Denver.
My name is Shiran Herskovich, and I am the lepidopterist here at Butterfly Pavilion, which is a fancy way of saying butterfly specialist or butterfly scientist. So I spend a lot of my days thinking of or surrounded by butterflies.
It could be worse.
Could be worse,
yeah.
Indeed.
So in this podcast episode, we are more or less retracing some of the steps that Vladimir Nabokov and his family took when they vacationed in the American West. A lot of that was here in Colorado, adjacent Wyoming, and of course, parts west of that. In about 1945, Nabokov, who was quite serious about the science of butterflies, had devised a theory concerning the evolution of the polyamidous blue butterfly, and that they migrated in waves over millions of years from Asia into the New World. And some 65, 66 years later, the Royal Society of London actually confirmed his theory as more than speculation. And part of this was because, well, when he was chasing butterflies, there wasn't gene sequence testing. So what can you tell us about the appearance and habits of this particular family of butterflies, the common blue?
Well, blue butterflies are, out of all of the butterflies, not the most immediately remarkable. They are quite small. Should I talk a little bit about the displays that I have?
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah. So I have with me a variety pack of butterflies. Most of these are tropical. They are quite large. They are flashy. They come in blues, bright blues. They come in reds. They come in greens and yellows. And in this display, the smallest butterfly that I have is a blue butterfly. And I don't mean blue the color, I mean blue the family, which is not confusing at all. Lycaenid butterflies are one of those families of butterflies that we talked about. They contain the coppers, the blues, the hair streaks, and they are the most delicate of the butterfly families. In fact, looking frail and delicate is one of those defining traits of them. Even their abdomens are less chunky than the ones that you would see in other butterflies. Their wings look so fragile, and they're almost outlined by this frail-looking margin. They often come in shimmery, light, almost purplish, lavender blues, and they're quite special. but they're small and generally don't draw the most attention to themselves. With their wings closed, they can be grayish or brownish and not the most immediately flashy. But when you see them all gathered in a puddle, they're almost like a group of fairies all hanging out together by a stream. So they're a special group of butterflies.
You know, I'm looking at this box of predominantly yellow, orange, brown butterflies, including what is clearly a monarch. He did this work, you know, throughout the 1950s. Is there any reason to believe that there are fewer of the butterflies that he might have encountered?
Yes, it is one of those unfortunate truths. When he was doing those expeditions, habitat tended to be a lot more vast, a lot more undisturbed. Pesticides weren't as widely used as they are today. And all of these are high pressures for butterfly populations. And studies have confirmed a rate of decline in butterflies, not just in Colorado, but across the American West, and not across the American West only, but really throughout the world. And this trend applies to most groups in the tree of life. We're losing branches, sometimes even faster than we can describe them. And that is the case with some moth species, some butterfly species. We sometimes, even though butterflies are one of the most charismatic groups of insects, more butterflies keep being described, more butterflies keep being listed as threatened or even endangered. The silver spot butterfly, native to the state of Colorado, has just been listed in the Endangered Species Act as threatened.
Hmm. Part two, researching Lolita, a busman's holiday. I had to inquire with Dr. Shiner about Lolita, which Nabokov reportedly researched and began writing on these butterfly hunting trips. The book specifically includes locations in Colorado, some with fictional names, and some factual, like Telluride. Now, he's writing or imagining Lolita during some of these trips west.
Oh, absolutely. He actually is very specific that his trips to Colorado are, the writing of Lolita happens on his trips to Colorado. He says quite specifically that this is in the essay that appears after Lolita. It's called On a Book Entitled Lolita. He says, every summer, my wife and I go butterfly hunting. The specimens are deposited at scientific institutions such as the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard or the Cornell University Collection. The locality labels pinned under these butterflies will be a boon to some 21st century scholar with a taste for recondite biography. It was at such of our headquarters as Telluride, Colorado, Afton, Wyoming, Portal, Arizona, and Ashland, Oregon, that Lolita was energetically resumed in the evenings or on cloudy days. So that's what brought him out here, or it was out here that he wrote Lolita. And catch butterflies, and when he couldn't, when the weather wouldn't cooperate, or in the evenings, he would write Lolita.
And he was putting this together on index cards, I understand.
Correct. That's how he wrote and would organize them.
I also wished to know more about what Nabokov would think of the speculation in readings of Lolita regarding themes and narrative structure, those which are related to butterfly behavior and the notions of metamorphosis. Were they an exaggeration of Nabokov's style and intent? So he directly comments on what a poor scientist of butterflies Humbert would have been.
Indeed, Nabokov actively discourages the reading of Lolita in conjunction with Lepidoptera. He says that Humbert, or H.H. as he calls him in the quotation here, knows nothing about Lepidoptera. In fact, I went out of my way to indicate that he confuses the hawk moths visiting flowers at dusk with gray hummingbirds. Another example is that in an essay entitled Lolita Lepidoptera, written by Diana Butler, she claims that, quote, in Lolita, Nabokov has transposed his own passion for butterflies into his hero's passion for nymphets, to which Nabokov responded Nabokov characterized her assertion as pretentious nonsense, and Vera Nabokov, on her husband's behalf, states that, quote, there is no connection whatsoever either in his, Nabokov's, work or in his mind between entomology and Humbertology.
That's what we would call a classic burn.
But my contention is that actually the connection between Lolita and Lepidoptera is in not so much in the plot or the theme or lepidopterological references, but actually this, the way the text is produced and its style. Because if you're going to be a good lepidopterist or a lepidopterist, you're going to have what is called a good eye. And this is this paying attention, right? This being able to know and to see. And there's a very famous sort of story Nabokov relates in Speak Memory about how little, he says, it's astounding how little the ordinary person notices butterflies. And he gives the following story that none, calmly replied that sturdy Swiss hiker with Camus in his rucksack, when purposely asked by me for the benefit of my incredulous companion if he had seen any butterflies while descending the trail where, a moment before, you and I had been delighting in swarms of them. Nabokov always sees the butterflies and importantly also knows and understands that there have to be particular flora around for those butterflies to be there. And that's why it's so important, I think, the course that I teach, right, that we're set out here in the Rocky Mountain West, specifically Colorado, but the larger Rocky Mountain West. And again, these links to his childhood home and the vicinity, the area that he loved so much and missed so much, longed for, and where he ended up settling in his later years outside of Montreux and spending his time in the mountains there. That's the home for these butterflies. They need that landscape. They coexist. And I think when you read a novel like Lolita, the detail in the description, this is, to me, one of the moments that undergirds the course I teach.
Part 3, The Reluctant Translator. I wanted to go a little further with a discussion of Nabokov as a translator, and specifically a self-translator, executing his own translation of Lolita, written in English and eventually translated to Russian. This podcast supports a literary journal regarding works in translation and the art of translation. By the time that Nabokov began to write novels and short stories in English, he had several novels and novellas already published in the Russian language. I know as a translator, he translated French works to Russian and English to Russian. Famously, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland from English to Russian. And Lolita is finally published in the Russian language some 10 years, I believe, after the English edition. And the translation is by Nabokov himself. Might you offer some insight into Nabokov's gifts as a translator and with self-translation?
So Nabokov had quite an unusual childhood. He didn't think it was unusual. He grew up trilingual, speaking Russian, English, and French. It would not have been unusual for someone of his background and social class to grow up bilingually. speaking Russian and French, but he also grew up speaking English and therefore was proficient in all three from an early age. He wrote in Russian under the pen name Vladimir Sirin to distinguish himself mostly from his father and his father's writings. And with the outbreak of war, his family moved around in Europe, and he probably could have written in French and in English just as easily. But his first English translations started coming out while he was still writing in Russian. Some of them were translated independently of him by other translators. And his first works that he self-translated were actually out of frustration with the translations. When he saw the translation of Winifred Roy had done of Camera Obscura, if you look at the manuscript, or actually it's not a manuscript, I guess, it's a copy of Winifred Roy's text in English, which is titled Camera Obscura, seems like a good straightforward literal translation of it. He's retranslated it in the margins. And that later became Laughter in the Dark, not a literal translation. And there are major changes. So I think I don't necessarily agree with a lot of with a good amount of the scholarship about sort of the narrative about why Nabokov self-translated or what prompted him. But in this case, I mean, I think there was a clear dissatisfaction. And if you read through his correspondence with his publishers, he was quite happy when that translation, I think it's something along the lines of, oh, all of the copies of Winifred Roy's translations were in some kind of warehouse that got bombed. Good, may they never see the light of day sort of thing. It was horrible. But these were sort of one of his first active uses of the English language for his own works. And when he emigrated to the U.S. is when he begins composing directly in English. And so I don't know that he ever abandons writing in Russian. I think that's a narrative I don't quite agree with. But certainly, I mean, he takes on both what he calls the Englishing of his Russian works. And I think he writes quite a lot about that in the forewords to the translations. He often partners with other folks, either his son, quite often he translates with Dmitry his own works. He also works with folks like Gleb Struve and Michael Scammell in bringing the Russian works into English, along with composing in English. So these things are happening simultaneously. Sometimes these translations come out quickly. Sometimes there are quite long lags between when the Russian work has been written and when the English translation appears. Sometimes there are minor changes, and sometimes there are whole-scale revisions, as in the case of Laughter in the Dark, as a rewriting of Camera Obscura. So it's hard to speak of his self-translations as following a specific pattern. So that would be sort of the rendering of the Russian works into English. And it's also difficult to speak about Nabokov as a self-translator in relation to his very clear opinions in writing about how one should translate, right? A very prescriptive approach to the act of translation, which he writes about, talking about his own work as a translator, specifically of Yevgeny Onegin, his advocating a literal approach to translation, which he did not take in his own self-translating practice. I think it's self-translation here almost seems to be an act of rewriting, sort of a self-collaboration, if you will, more so than an act of translation where there's no relationship to the author. When he seems to work with a collaborator who is not himself, Nabokov tends to get more of a literal translation that then he edits. I've worked a lot with the manuscripts that he's received, say, from his son, and he'll do some line edits to those, or the ones from Michael Scammell or Struve when he's done the collaborative work.
I believe your position is that Lolita is truly an American novel. There are English words that don't even exist in an Imperial Russian vocabulary or even a Soviet vocabulary. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Nabokov, as a self-translator, primarily translates, as I said, his Russian works into English. In fact, calls them Englishings of his Russian work. And there are only two texts that he writes in English that he then renders into Russian. And one of them is Lolita. And he translates it into Russian. And it's fascinating to look at his notes as he's doing that, his manuscripts. He has certain words in English that he writes a note to himself. What is the Soviet word for? Not the Russian word, but what is the Soviet word for? Right? This is a novel set in 1950s U.S. It's a road novel. Lolita is an American teen. She's obsessed with pop culture, magazines, sodas. So words like bubblegum, right? What is the Soviet word? Right? This isn't an item that Nabokov has a word for. It's fascinating to sort of see him render this text into Russian in a totally different manner, not an American text by any stretch of the imagination. Nabokov pens an autobiography in 1951 entitled Conclusive Evidence, a Memoir. He renders that into Russian in 1954 under the title Drugi Berga, Other Shores. One might imagine writing one's autobiography of one's childhood in Russia would be not difficult in certain respects to render in Russian, but there are changes, and not just linguistic changes. There are changes of events in the Russian version. And then he retranslates his autobiography into English and appears in 1966 under the title most of us would know and under Speak Memory, an Autobiography Revisited. And it is yet again, I will say, transformed in this new version in English, which I think raises a number of issues about what we mean when we say translation.
Now, one of the chief reasons we're here speaking today is that you offer a course to students on Nabokov's Butterflies, which I understand includes field studies. Great place for it in both our backyards. I'd love our listeners to hear about the content of these classes, the course contributors and students that you've encouraged through this experience.
So I began teaching at Colorado College in 2000, and it sort of seemed kind of an ideal constellation of events. As I mentioned, Nabokov would come out to Colorado, it turns out, to the Rocky Mountain West and catch butterflies. And right about the time I started teaching here, a number of books had just come out. One of them was entitled Nabokov's Blues by Kurt Johnson and Steve Coates that detailed Nabokov's work as a lepidopterist and sort of the contributions he had made to taxonomy and systematics as a lepidopterist. Turns out his theories had all been proven correct. Also at this time, Robert Michael Pyle and Brian Boyd put out a book called Nabokov's Butterflies that gathered not only Nabokov's writings on butterflies in his literary texts, but all of his scientific writings for the first time on butterflies in one place. So there were these two texts that came out. And here I was, living in Colorado, teaching at Colorado College, which has this strange block plan system where students take one class at a time for 3.5 weeks, which means they can leave campus since they have no other course obligations. And I thought, okay, I think the universe is telling me something. So I approached a colleague in the biology department who's an entomologist who told me she worked on bugs. She wasn't sure if she liked Nabokov. She had read Lolita and thought that Humpert Humpert was a little disturbing. And I said it was okay that I loved Nabokov enough for both of us. She just had to teach me about Lepidoptera. And she said, okay. So we created a course together, and it was going to combine Nabokov's two passions, Lepidoptera and literature. And Stephen Jay Gould had a fantastic article about Nabokov's passions, and we sort of went from there and came up with sort of some concepts in Lepidoptera and paired them with literary texts, poetry, Nabokov, multifaceted as a writer. I mean, and in fact, most of his writings that sort of come from the same places or share some of the same concerns, we might say, of Lepidoptera, because it's not really about where are there butterflies in Nabokov. In fact, Lolita would be the last place that you would look. Studies that others have done on Lepidoptera in Lolita, Nabokov was pretty disparaging of them. He said Humbert is a horrible Lepidopterist. He knows nothing about nature. He mistakes this for that, et cetera, et cetera. You know, thinking of Lolita as a butterfly, you know, not really the right way to go. That's not to say there aren't references to butterflies in Lolita, and there are some specific markers, right, to his time out in Colorado. Dolores Hayes, our main character in Lolita, is named for possibly Dolores, Colorado, outside of Telluride, where the last scene of the novel takes place, when Humbert is standing, looking down, and hears the voices of children playing and laments the loss of Lolita's voice among them. And of course, I spoke to my colleague in biology and said, well, we have to go there. And she said, well, we can't during the academic school year because the butterflies won't be flying then. It'll be too cold, which was very depressing to find out. But we did. We changed our travel plans and still managed to go catch butterflies. But there are many, many texts of Nabokov's that work very, very well with butterflies. He has poems on butterflies. He has short stories. But we decided to build the class around specific ideas that are shared. The way in which Nabokov, the novelist, describes, that is the act of being a lepidopterist, being able to find these butterflies, to know their habitat, and then to describe them, the work to be able to be. There's a reason he was a taxonomer and a systematist, to be able to look at the scales. This is before the ability to do DNA or any of this, to look at the genitalic structures through a microscope in that kind of detail. It explains why Nabokov is the kind of writer he is. And that's sort of the way we set this course up. My colleague and I, she told me what she would look at as a scientist, as a lepidopterist, well, an entomologist. And I sort of tried to match where I saw that in his work as a writer. So Stephen Jay Gould, I mentioned, has an essay. It's entitled No Science Without Fancy, No Art Without Facts, The Lepidoptery of Vladimir Nabokov. He says the major linkage of science and literature lies in some distinctive underlying approach that Nabokov applied equally to both domains, a procedure that conferred the same special features upon all his efforts. In my mind, this is sort of an aesthetic, as a literary scholar, that I would maybe say is this detail and accuracy in his description. And the way he describes it in Strong Opinions is, as an artist and a scholar, I prefer the specific detail to the generalization, images to ideas, obscure facts to clear symbols, and the discovered wild fruit to synthetic jam.
Are there ways that this course and discovery of Nabokov's plural passions of butterflies and literature, are there ways that this has changed the mind of young people reading this text, perhaps for the first time or the second time?
I certainly think so. I think that a knowledge of Lepidoptera can help facilitate a reading of Lolita that allows for an appreciation of the aesthetic of the text. And I had a student in the journals that the students kept. They wrote that before this class, I was not aware of the fact that butterflies even had scales, much less that someone would sit down with the intention to count them. I perceived an image, a butterfly without the awareness that there was a smaller world within that image, a world of scales refracting the light. I really think knowledge of this specific practice drove my reading of Lolita. Humbert Humbert presented me with this revolting, perverted image of desire. When I look at that image, all I want to do is turn away. But when I look into the smaller parts of that image, I find a world of scales, both metaphorical and judicial. The details, the scales, break up the light cast by the glow of Humbert Humbert's desire, and I am left in the refraction, the iridescence of art.
It's very moving. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I really have enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And a final word, as quoted from the author.
In an interview in 1957, Nabokov remarks that butterflies help me in my writing. Very often when I go hunting and there are no butterflies, I am thinking. I wrote most of Lolita this way. I wrote it in motels or parked cars.
I want to offer my sincere thanks to Dr. Corin Shiner from Colorado College and Shirin Herskovich from the Butterfly Pavilion in Westminster, Colorado, which is open to the public. Asymptote is the premier journal dedicated to world literature in translation. Until next time, goodbye.